Welcome to Classic 4x4, the podcast for classic four-wheel drive collectors, restorers, and enthusiasts. I'm your host, Chris Piccone, and you can follow the podcast on Instagram at Classic4x4Podcast, and you can follow my trials, tribulations, escapades, and ridiculousness of collecting and restoring classic four-wheel drives at Overland by the Sea. Today we have a granular, down the rabbit hole, bottom of the funnel guest who is the preeminent authority on International Harvesters and the International Harvester light trucks, which is, you don't come across a lot of harvesters in general out there in the world, especially in the classic four-wheel drive space, though they're very popular. And you certainly do not come across people that have his level of knowledge. So without further ado, I want to introduce and welcome Dan Hayes from the Binder Boneyard to the Classic 4x4 podcast.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. I'm so appreciative for you to join us. There aren't a lot of people out there that have your level of knowledge and expertise when it comes to International Harvester and their light trucks. I mean, they made light trucks for roughly about 40 years, and they didn't really last that long, mostly because they just rotted out. So your level of expertise and understanding is greatly appreciated. We're going to have a lot of fun today. So for those of you that don't follow Dan on Instagram, you got to follow him at Binder Boneyard. Also, check out his website, The Binder Boneyard. He also has a podcast. He does about a half hour every week and talks about unique technical things with International Harvester light trucks. Also has a YouTube channel. But most importantly, what does the Binder Boneyard do? The Binder Boneyard is a restoration and repair shop just dedicated to International Harvester light trucks. They also have their own line of parts, new parts, a lot of accessories, but they sell new and used parts, and you can buy those directly on their website or at their eBay store. So one thing I really want to talk about and kind of start off with is, and I start off with every guest like this, is Dan, like, who is the man behind the shop, right? where do you live? Where did you come from? And how did you build the preeminent International Harvester light truck shop?
Well, I grew up in the western part of Oregon, about an hour south of Portland, the rainy, gross part. And I didn't even know what internationals were. Like, normally you talk to an international guy and he's part of a family that they had tractors and combines and their grandpa drove travelalls and whatever. And I didn't have any exposure to the brand at all. I had no idea what they were. So grew up in the valley, and then maybe about 12 years ago during the old housing crash, I moved to Central Oregon through a series of mishap, really nowhere to go. I was actually living in my travel all because I didn't have any place to go. My folks had an empty rental house, because at the time you couldn't rent a place anywhere, or you couldn't find someone to rent. They were just, it was a crazy time. I mean, you remember 2008, yeah. 9, 10, it was like just abandoned ship. And so, my mom says, hey, go crash at the house in Redmond, see if you can't find a job over there. And so, got a job working at a hardware store, and then was able to start paying rent at my folks' place and claw my way back out from there. But I'm 43 years old, so I was born a year before Harvester went out of business, because they quit making trucks in 1980. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of weird when I'm pretty young in this industry, compared to the other shops and the other guys that have been doing it. I'm a little bit early, but it's a long story, but
9 years ago you somehow took your passion and transformed it into a profession and started the shop. Like, where did that come from?
So the Binder Boneyard is actually my third attempt at business. I grew up in kind of an entrepreneurial family, sort of. I grew up on a farm. My dad worked at the sawmill, but to make extra money, we raised hogs. So we had, 20 head of sows, and, I did that. And then we also cut and sold firewood. And so early on, I learned that, like, hey, you can make money and not have to have a 9-to-5. But no one ever taught me how to make enough money to not need a 9-to-5. All I ever learned was how to just make a few bucks here and there. Uh-huh. So, get out of high school. I went to college for a couple of years to be a journalist, believe it or not, which is probably where my Instagram photo skills come from. But, decided that making money right then was more important than staying in school, spending money. So, started working, bought my first Scout in 2000, in like September, October of 2000. I can't remember exactly. And the reason for that was I had two-wheel drive trucks. I had my first truck was a 61 Ford unibody. So real rare. They didn't make a ton of them. It's whatever. Paid $500 for it. None of the lights worked, but I could drive it back and forth to school and not get in trouble because I went to a really small school, back roads, whatever. No, nobody hassled you. And then my next truck was a 69 Ford F-100. Again, two-wheel drive, half ton. I was using that to sell firewood because now I'm 17, 18. My dad's like, hey, because my dad got laid off from the sawmill and he went to work fallen timber full time. So he's like, hey, go to the logging job. There's, a deck of firewood logs, go cut a cord out of it. So he wouldn't actually give me any money. My dad never gave me money, but he would say, hey, there's a cord of wood sitting over there, load it up, go to town and sell it. And so that's how I was making some money while I was in school.
Which is a better lesson than just handing it to you.
Yeah.
You probably look back at that as something now that you're very thankful for.
Yeah, I definitely learned the value of there's no such thing as a 5-day work week. It's just if you're awake and you got something to do, just go do it. And, So all my friends, I had two-wheel drive trucks. Well, my buddy started getting into four-wheel drives. I had a friend had a, K10 half-ton Chev. Another friend had a Jeep. Another guy's dad built him a Bronco. And they're all going snow-wheeling and having fun. And I'm stuck in my half-ton Ford or I'm riding, in the back of a Blazer getting bounced around. And I'm like, I need to be part of this too. And I didn't have a ton of money. So I hit the old truck trader because in 2000, there was no Craigslist. There was no,
head over to the grocery store and pull the truck trader out. Yep.
Exactly. Lean against the magazine rack for half an hour and, write down the phone numbers of the ones you wanted to call. And, there was this Scout in the back of the truck trader in the other section, because they didn't even have a space for it. It was with like the Volkswagen Vrux and homemade stuff. And it was $800 and it was already lifted, had 36 inch swampers on it. I was like, that's it. That's the one for me because it's in my price range. Went and looked at it. Bright red, white top, just the quintessential like late 80s, early 90s build, like just stupid TSLs, tons of lift. The leaf springs looked like smiley faces. They were so arched. It was awful looking back at it. But as a 19-year-old kid who I didn't know anything. Like my dad did not teach me anything about mechanics at all. Because the farm was a hobby farm, rather than repair something, you just bought another one because you didn't have time. You know, you have your, he had his 9 to 5 at the sawmill, which actually it was, he was working swing shift. So it was like 3 to midnight or 3 to 1 in the morning. And then that way he could work on the farm during the day and then go to work at night. And, so it was, I learned that you just replace it. Don't even bother trying to fix it. So we had a bunch of, you know, looking back, we had a fortune in classic trucks parked down in the lower pasture because he would have, he just, a truck would get a hole in the radiator and he would just park it. And looking back, man, I'd love to have that C10 now, you know, because it'd be worth a fortune. It was nice. That cool, you know, it was blue, all this stuff. But in 1985, it was a $200 truck and you just pushed it down the hill and, you know, got another one.
It was a pile. It was like a $1,000 pile of rust then, which turned into a $1 million pile of rust today.
Yeah. Yeah. So I didn't learn anything from him as far as mechanics go. So I buy this Scout. I drive it home. 4-cylinder, 4-speed, which I didn't realize that was a rare combination at the time. And now I'm forced to learn how to work on this thing. And so I had to get smart real fast. And again, no internet. So it wasn't like you can just go on YouTube and watch a video. So, you know, bought some manuals. There was a company called Binder Books. They're still in business. But Binder Books sold reprints of repair manuals. And so I was able to get a repair manual and just started reading that and learning how to fix it. And then, of course, you can't just have one Scout. I found a Scout 2 sitting on the side of the highway one day. It had been sitting there for sale for so long that when I called the number on the sign, the guy didn't know what I was talking about.
Like, there were times where that actually could happen, where a Scout could be for sale and people would forget it that they were selling it, right? You know, mm-hmm. Today, yeah. If one lasts a week, you'd be surprised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It was a 73 Scout 2, 304 automatic. Real nice, actually, not much rust, had some damage, but, no real rust to speak of. And it was $700. And, so I aired up the tires because the tires had gone flat from sitting, and I drove that one home. And then, anyway, I joined a international club that had just formed over there. And, you know, there are a bunch of club members. And then I started seeing that there was this hole where only one or two people in the club actually knew how to work on them. And so I'm like, hey, I could probably help this guy, you know, change a transmission or pull, you know, swap intake or do whatever that needs to be done. And so I started doing that and then decided to try it as a business and then try to duplicate what my dad did, which was work a 9 to 5 and then work on stuff on the side. But I found out pretty fast that I'm not that disciplined. Mm-hmm. And I was like 22, 23. So it was, you know, Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday morning, just wrecked from the bars or whatever, you know.
Doing the things you should do at 22 and 23 years old. Yeah.
Yeah. So I wasn't working on work. And so, you know, I'd work on it during the week, a couple hours here and there. And then, you know, so I started getting kind of a backlog and then people were getting mad at me for not getting through their, you know, relatively simple jobs, which I recognize now that, you know, they were pretty easy. But looking back when you're 23, 24, you've only pulled 2 transmissions in your whole career, but you're telling people that you can do it because you're in that fake it till you make it stage. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it didn't work out. I made some good friends. I learned a ton. But it didn't work out. And then, you know, some other stuff, you know, personal life stuff happened and it wasn't working. So, yeah. So fast forward to another business attempt at fabrication, because that was my career. About 23 to 30, I worked in fab shops, mostly commercial, industrial fab. We built, I worked in a shop that made like vibrating conveyors for rock quarries and heavy equipment, real heavy stuff. And you know, bounced around a couple of different shops. And so then I started my own fabrication shop in 2010, you know, during the downturn, right? Because I got settled in at my folks' place, started making some income at the hardware store. I found a shop space for rent for almost nothing because of the downturn. Like, there were businesses were fleeing, everything was shutting down. So there were these commercial spaces that were like $400 a month. I'm like, geez, I can make that, you know, just recycling my beer cans. And so, tried that again, you know, marketing was tough, get out there. People didn't have any money. You know, it lasted a couple of years again, doing it on the side, working my 9 to 5 and then working in the shop. And, that didn't work out. So move everything, all my filled up my garage at the house with all of my equipment, because I had a steady 9 to 5, even during the downturn, I was able to go to other shops that were going out of business, and I was buying, welders and hand tools. And, you know, like, I bought a shoebox full of drill bits of like big, like 1 inch and 1.25 inches, like huge drill bits that if you were to go buy now, they're $150 a bit. And I bought this whole shoebox for $10 because the guy was just like, I can't take it with me. So he, you know, so stuff like that, but I had nowhere to put it. So it was just in my garage, So my poor girlfriend at the time would go out to do laundry, and she would like scoot down the little path that I had to get to the washer and dryer, because the garage was packed with TIG welders, MIG welders, drill presses, you know, like all the stuff that I need for my shop, because I've had this dream of having my own shop since I was 22, you know, when I, or, you know, even before that, maybe even a little bit, you know, because I'm a product of the monster garage era, you know, where I'm 20 and I'm watching, you know, Jesse James beating out metal and building Harleys and stuff, and you're, and it just looks cool, and you're like, yeah, I want to do that too, but I'm going to apply it to my hobby, you know, like, yeah, I mean, every, you know, I don't want to build motorcycles, I want to build scouts. And so, you know, so I started buying all this stuff that I see on the these metal fab shows that popped up, you know, with the Discovery Channel and all that stuff. And, you know, that was just my dream, I guess. And so I was going to do it, even if I meant storing everything in my garage and working in my driveway, you know, because that's what I did.
Is that how it started? So 9 years ago, is that how the Binder Boneyard started, was tools in your garage, a hoarder-esque tool set up in your garage, and just wrench on them in the driveway?
Yeah. So, I was working at a fab shop because as the economy recovered, I had changed jobs a couple of times, and I finally was working in a metal fab shop. And the owner of that shop was not a great boss. And I just kind of got tired of getting yelled at all the time, and, you know, just dumb stuff. I had my uncle died, and I needed to help my family out, but my grandpa had died the month before, so I had used up all of my leave time for my grandpa's funeral and all that. And then when my uncle died, I was like, hey, I need to take off. And my boss was like, no, you already used up your time. And I was like, well, then I'm quitting. Yeah. I'm done. I just grabbed my toolbox, and I just started pushing it out the door. And because I was already building internationals, I would buy one on Craigslist for $500, clean it up, get it running, fix it, drive it. I'd drive them for like 6 months just to make sure they were perfect. And then I would sell them on Facebook or Instagram, because that was just starting to take off, like Instagram sales and stuff. And I'd sell them there for $3,000. And so then I would buy another $500 one, because you could at the time still. And and do it again. And so I was making income, and then people started calling like, hey, do you have this part? Or, you know, I saw in your Instagram picture that you have five Scouts in your backyard. Does any of them have a good fender you want to sell? And so then, you know, I started selling some parts. And so when I got yelled at about my uncle's funeral, I was just like, that's it. I'm going to just, this is my sign that I need to go. And that's what it did, you know? So,
and now you could be thankful for that guy, right? The best thing that ever happened to you in your life was that guy making that bad decision, which sent you on this path to where you're at today, which is absolutely amazing. Everybody has a story like that. Everybody has a story where, like, hey, you know, this was a passion, and because of this thing at the time, which was devastating, and maybe at the time I thought it wasn't the best decision, but I still made that decision. I stood behind it, but turned out to be the in the end, the best decision that happened to you. So when did you actually move into a shop? When did Binder Boneyard move into a shop?
So we built a little building behind the house. So I had a, I put a roll up garage door on the back of my garage. And then.
So you had like a pull through?
So that I could, because I, if I was working out in front of the house, the neighbors would get weird about it. I didn't live in a great neighborhood, but still, you know, you got a truck out there with the engine hanging off a hoist and whatever. The it just didn't look great. So I put a roll-up door on the back, and that was one of the upsides to having a house that my folks owned. Was like, I kind of had some leeway there. Like, I had an electrician come in and wire the garage for legit power, because I had welders and stuff. And I just want to be very, very clear that my parents, even though I lived in that house, I paid full price rent. Like, they didn't help me out. It wasn't like, oh, give us $100 for utilities and we'll be even. No, at the time I was paying $650 a month, which was market price around there, plus my utility, plus everything else. And then they would just show up. Like, I'd be appalled if my landlord showed up at any other, like, I'm like, what are you doing here? No, my mom would just take her key and come in, you know, like, mom,
that's classic.
Like, what do you, you didn't even call. Like, this is, yes, it's your house that I'm renting, but come on, like, send me a text or something. Like, just show up. And
that is too funny.
But anyway, so, put some gravel down. I put up a Costco tarp garage, a 12 by 20 tarp garage behind the house that I could pull a rig into and at least work out of the weather kind of. So that's where I was working. That lasted about 6 months. We poured a concrete pad. And then I bought one of those metal carport buildings, like the put it up yourself kind of things. But I had somebody put it up and put that up. That was, it was that 17 by 27. It was a weird number. But anyways, put that up. And then I was able to transfer some of my tools out of the garage into that space. And I was working in there. That lasted about another 6 months. And I got so much work, and I was so inundated with people wanting stuff done, that I had to move into another building. So I rented a shop in an adjacent town, it was like 10 miles away, got an employee, which kind of worked out good because he was fresh out of prison and couldn't get a job anywhere. And, you know, I took a gamble on him, and for the most part, I was pretty happy with how it turned out. There was some gray areas there that, you know, I, looking back, I should have noticed a little earlier, but I was just desperate for help because we were getting so far behind. And then, you know, I was in that shop for 2 years, moved to another shop, was in that shop for 2 years, and now I'm in the shop that I'm in now. And we actually own this piece of property. My moves before were forced moves because the landlord sold the place or didn't like what I was doing there anymore or whatever. And so, had to move. So that's how we ended up in the shop that we're in now.
That's awesome, man. That's super cool. And it's amazing how these things start, you know, how you have these pivots and this one little thing, this boss was just got on your bad side one day. And then you ended up taking this trajectory and becoming literally like the preeminent harvester shop in the country. That is super cool. We're using the word binder a lot, and a lot of people don't realize what a binder is and how it relates to harvesters and that nickname. You know, can you tell our listeners about the history of binder, why harvesters are nicknamed binders?
Well, International started out in the 1800s making farm equipment, and it was actually called McCormick Deering, and then they merged with some other companies and became International Harvester in the early 1900s. Their number one selling machine was a horse-drawn piece of equipment that would take corn stalks or wheat stalks and then bind them together into a clump or bunches that you could carry or load into a wagon or something. I'm probably butchering this history up, but that's how it was described to me. So they were corn binders was how, you know, that's what they just, the old timers were calling these pieces of equipment, corn binders. Well, then they started making trucks. International was making heavy trucks, and the slang among all the truck drivers and farmers and everything, they just started calling them corn binders. And then, you know, you shorten it down to binder, because we're just lazy, I guess. I don't know. You just say binder. And
yeah.
And so then that's where my name came from, the Binder Boneyard, because I needed to name my business something that wouldn't get me sued by International. Mm-hmm. Because even though they went out of business in 1980, they restructured. And then there's Navistar. That's mm-hmm. who they became. But they still own the rights to all those names, like Scout and International and, mm-hmm. You know, the emblems, all that stuff. And so I was nervous that if I named my business, you know, Scout Masters or something, that they were going to call me and tell me to stop selling T-shirts with the Scout on it. So I just went, I just avoided that whole thing and named myself something that was, you know, known in the community, because if you got International, you've heard the term corn binder. Yeah. So that's where I got my name from.
That's cool. The you know, you talk about you know, all these cool projects, and I'm sure you work on projects for people all over the country, if not the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. you have transport trucks that are dropping base projects, you know, for a guy that you've never met, that you've talked on the phone, that, you know, lives mm-hmm. somewhere east of the Mississippi, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and we probably never meet other than getting payment and putting it back on a truck. But what is, you know, before we start talking about some of the projects that you've worked on, and I'm sure you've worked on some insane projects where guys have just said, oh, there's no budget. And when you're like, well, you can't work around a budget. You have to work on some type of budget. They're like, okay, how does like 250, 300 sound? You're like, I don't know if I can even build something that costs 250, 300, but I'm sure we all mm-hmm. can figure it out. What do you daily drive yourself? Like, what is your daily driver from the house to the shop every day?
So it goes between, I have a 64 International Travelette, which is a crew cab pickup. It's a 3/4 ton four-wheel drive. Being 64, it's kind of that round body, real curvy windshield. It's like driving a fishbowl. Then the other truck is my 71 Travelette, which is what we call it square body. Mm-hmm. That's a D series truck, and we've converted that to diesel. It's got an International diesel out of a school bus in it, and I drive that one a lot because it gets good mileage, and it's kind of recognizable. It's kind of the flagship truck. It's on all of our stickers and our t-shirts and stuff like that. Those are the two that I drive the most. Unless we have a customer truck that we are getting ready to deliver or finish mm-hmm. up, then I drive that every day to shake them down and make sure that it's good to go for the customer. But yeah, those are my two.
That's super fun, man. That's so I'm sure at this point you're working on a lot of later Harvester stuff, you know, the you know, late 60s to the 70s, but it sounds like you like that, you know, mid to early stuff. That's what makes you happy.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm sure you probably see that with the Jeeps and stuff that you work on, that every era has its own kind of soul and fingerprint. Like, it just, there's something about the 60s trucks that they are the right combination of classic but modern. You know, they're 12 volt systems, they've got, you know, 5 round gauges, they've got indicator lights, they've got dash lights that actually light up stuff, they, you know, the doors shut decently, the heaters work good. Because, you know, you get in the 50s trucks that were 6 volt, positive ground, you got weird stuff, you know, no dash lights, or the turn signals only work in one direction or whatever, you know. So you get these, the 60s was kind of a nice mix of both. Because in the 70s, you start getting with the wiring harnesses get more complicated, and there's, you know, more plugs and more lights and more carpeting and insulation and plastic, and they're harder to work on, you know. They're more comfortable. I'm not, you know, they're definitely, the 70s trucks were a big jump from the 60s trucks, but it's just, I don't know, it's not quite classic enough for me. I really like that 60s, like I say, with the round windshields and the big side glass and that kind of stuff.
That's cool. Yeah, the you know, throughout the years, like you know, you said you bought your first Harvester, which was a Scout, in fall of 2000, right? So 20, almost 22 years ago right now. Through that, you have worked on a lot of your projects that are your own, now outside of customer projects, but on your own, like you said, like you were buying them for 500, 800, you know, getting them right and moving them on down the line. What was the one Harvester that you bought it, you got it for a great number, you put a lot of love into it, and you moved it on down the line and sold it, and you were like, man, I regret that. I wish I still had it today.
Yeah, man. I mean, there were some travelalls that I've had over the years that I kind of regret letting go, because at the time, I didn't realize how nice they were. How, you know, how rust free it was, or how optioned it was, because I just didn't know. I was just green, you know, like my first Scout with that 4-cylinder and 4-speed. I didn't realize that was a rare combination. And so when I sold that Scout, because I did sell it, actually, I didn't sell it, I traded it for a Travelall. And then later, when I wanted another early Scout, all I were finding were these 3-speeds. I'm like, what? Why are there so many 3-speeds? Like, oh, dummy. Turns out you had one of the rare 4-speed ones. So, you know, it's just learning. Like, that's where the, let's see if I can back up. The business is built on me ruining a lot of stuff in my early years, because I had no one to teach me. I had no skills. You know, so I was wrecking stuff, not realizing how I was doing it was wrong until it was too late. And then, you know, and so now I can use that experience with the business, and we do them right the first time. We do, you know, we know what to look for. I know what's the you know, trouble spots, whatever. So it's the history of just buying them and selling them and learning, you know, oh, that one was a rare one because of this. And then, oh, that's that one. And then now with the internet and talking to other enthusiasts, they solidify your thought, like, hey, was this one really rare because of this? And they go, oh yeah, there was only a few of those. Cause I know you say that I'm the foremost, whatever, but there are other, or there are quite a few other, really knowledgeable people out there, that are in this business. You know, John Glancy, he owns Super Scout Specialists. I mean, his dad worked for Harvester right up until the end. Jeff Ismail from IH Parts America. They, you know, he's his store. They're probably the number one seller of parts. Their stock is the largest. He, another guy that knows an incredible amount about this stuff. And it's funny though, when him and I'll talk and I'll say something and he'll go, really? I didn't know that. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's like this. And I'll show him. So even though we've both been in it for so long, we're still learning from each other, the little details and the little pieces that, you know, we think we're just when you think you know it all, then you're like, oh, really? Because I didn't know that. And, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I appreciate the title or the, you know, the descriptive
word. You're on my podcast, so I got to make you sound good, right? You know, it's true, yeah. but I'm always going to make you sound good. That's super cool. I mean, it's the Harvesters have taken a, especially the Scout 2s have taken gone to a realm very parallel to the Ford Broncos, right? Mm-hmm. So it's less like enthusiasts and guys that are like, hey man, you know, I'm cool with that $100,000 Scout. Like I got $100,000 to burn and I want a Scout, right? You know? Mm-hmm. So yeah. You're doing a lot of really cool projects for a lot of really fun people. Have you ever done any celebrity projects? What's the most, like, the biggest budget a customer's ever given you to build out their project? What's the coolest project where you sit back and say, man, like, I can't believe we did that. That is the coolest thing that's come out of the shop right now.
You know, we're not necessarily known as a shop that does super duper high-end builds like that. We have done several $100,000 plus builds. But in the end, when you break it down by what parts are in it, the level of paint and body and insulation and everything else, $100,000 might have been a little bit low in the actual build cost, you know, and I'm notorious for selling myself short like that. Like we lose money all the time on builds because honestly, if every build got billed out correctly, every Scout we did would be $500,000, mm-hmm. you know, because it's just how it is. You know, you put the time, you're at the wire wheel all day, just polishing up bolt heads because mm-hmm. you've got to put that original IH fastener back in there to make it look right. Sometimes we're not doing that. Sometimes they just get new, you know, grade fives or grade eights and you just move on. But a lot of our compliments and a lot of what people want from us, because we do it, is that reusing of hardware, and you know, the right engine colors, because yeah, they want a really nice truck, but they want to open the hood and see those international valve covers. Mm-hmm. You know, so we do a lot in modernization of the original drivetrain, you know, putting five speeds on the old 345s and you know, Holley Sniper and other, you know, fuel injection stuff like that, and kind of bring them into the 21st century but still retaining that history of the engine. So we've done some that were, you know, just out there, you know, Dynatrack axles and coilovers and stuff. We have one that's going right now. It's kind of an overland build, you'd call it. It's got a 4BT Cummins, you know, five speed Atlas, Curry Pro Rock axles, King shocks, that kind of stuff. I haven't put that one out on social medias too much yet, because some of my customers
and are that's a private. Customer build.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah,
that's a new joke.
I don't have the budget for that myself.
Yeah.
so that's a customer build. But some of our customers are very private and they don't like their stuff. Like we did one for a guy that was probably our biggest budget one. He's literally a billionaire. Mm-hmm. out of Northern California, Bay Area guy, had developed some products for the medical industry that ended up being adopted by every hospital in the country pretty much. Mm-hmm. And so he was like 28 years old, Yeah. So it was it's really surreal. I've never actually met the guy. I've only ever dealt with one of his handlers, and you know, they just would cut checks and drop in every once in a while and check the project. And, you know, we delivered it and they drove it for a while and they, you know, wanted some tweaks made or change the lights or do this or do that. And, you know, but they were real specific, like, hey, don't put too much of this out there to the world, because, you know, we don't want people to know that when they see this scout going down the road, it's going to be driven by a guy that's worth this much money and, you know, get kidnapped or something. So I don't think it's much of a problem in America, but you know, it's still, it's valid concerns, and we take every customer's request real serious, you know? And so a lot of our, what we show on our social media is, more the average Joe builds, you know, the $60,000 to $80,000 stuff that is a little more attainable for a lot of people. You know, our daily driver type stuff.
But so, you're keeping it real, and that's awesome. Out of curiosity, that one that you did, which is the biggest budget one, where did that end up?
You know, I think we were just under 200.
Oh, okay. So that's actually not as bad as I thought, you know?
No, because it was one of those, they wanted the best of everything, but we kept the international engine.
Oh, okay, cool.
You know, like if we had done an LS or something like that, it might have raised the budget a little bit more. But, you know, that build was also 5 years ago now, too. Mm-hmm. So prices have come up on a lot of stuff, too. Yeah. That's one of the things we're working on, is adjusting pricing to keep up with everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, you used to get a junkyard LS for, you know, $2,500 and rebuild it. And now 6 liters are getting hard to find. And now junkyards are raising their prices on them. And, you know, and so now you're trying to buy whole trucks with these drivetrains. Well, now the used car market is through the roof. So you're trying to buy an 07 Silverado that used to, you know, your budget's $4,000. Well, the cheapest one you can find is $15,000. Like, what the hell, you know? So yeah, pricing is changing quick. And, so
you brought something up, like powertrain swaps. So in the in like the Jeep world, right? Especially with like you know, the AMC era Jeeps, you see a lot of people do powertrain swaps, especially to LSs. That's like very, very common. They'll pull the 258 or the 360 AMC, and they'll swap it to an LS. But in the Jeep world, that kills the value of them. Right. So, you know, when you see somebody that has like a 4-cylinder scrambler and they want to go 8-cylinder, though, you know, the 304, the 360 and the 401 AMC weren't available in that, you know, 5-year period of time for the CJ8, you're still better off putting that AMC 304, 360 or the 401 in, because if you throw an LS into it, it absolutely kills the value of it. Do you see that same thing happen in the harvester space?
No, it's actually the opposite. I've seen really nice, really well done scouts with original type drivetrains sell for $75,000-$80,000 on, you know, Mecum or, you know, some of the auction sites. And then a similarly built, equipped, painted truck with an LS and a 4L60 Dana 300 setup, and they're $125,000-$130,000.
Wow.
And, you know, it's almost like the LS actually improves the resale on it. Now, there's some caveats to that, like with a really special package, you know, like a Comanche 800B or a SR2 or a Snowstar or something that would bring more money, all original, especially to a collector, then yeah. But there were so few of those. They made, what, 2,000 Comanches in 70 and 71, and of all the ones that rusted away and everything else, there's probably only 150 of them left, 200 of them maybe out there in the world. And so those are bringing money stock, you know, whereas a basic Scout 800 or Scout 2 that wasn't a special package, you know, you, they're always bring more money when they're Chevy powered. Which,
and the reason I ask that question is because I see a lot of swapped Scouts. Mm-hmm. Hey, back in the day, you saw a lot of Jeeps, especially AMC era, you know, CJs, that had swaps, because the 360 wasn't that reliable. The 304 was a good V8, but it actually had comparable power to the 258 inline six. So it kind of almost didn't make sense. You know, the 401s weren't that easy to find, to swap out. So you saw, hey, the LSs made sense, but in this day and age, it's amazing how it's the exact opposite. You know, you throw an LS in a Scout 2 and it throws the value through the roof. You throw an LS in a CJ7 or a CJ8 and it kills it, you know, whereas if you just swapped it with a 258 or a 304 360, you know, it'll do the differential and spread is $10,000, $15,000, $20,000+, on a 40 on a CJ8 on a $40,000 to $50,000 CJ8, that's a big difference. But I'll tell you, almost all the guys I know that are real true enthusiasts in the Jeep space, they won't even look at LS swaps. They anything that's swapped out, it's just move on, not interested. Now, it could be the most beautiful 100-point restoration there ever was, if it doesn't have that factory powertrain, or an AMC powertrain, they're just not interested. But I will tell you, if it's got a 258 inline six with a T176 married to a Dana 300, that thing's doing some serious money, right? no matter what AMC era Jeep it's in. So that's cool. That's interesting how these different worlds are different depending on the type of collector and the enthusiast and their expectations. You know, one of the questions I always ask everybody is, you know, anybody that is, you know, really into something, whether they're a collector, enthusiast, a fabricator, you know, somebody that's really into, like yourself, into harvesters, and collects harvesters. I mean, I know you technically say you have a collection. You know, out in the back, you probably have 100 bodies that you know that are either for sale or pieces of it are for sale. And you know, but is there anything else that you collect that is like a fun passion or a hobby outside of just cars or other type of cars?
Not really. I guess I collect antiques, like old tools, old machinery, old, you know, war era stuff. I've got a closet full of Pendleton and Filsons and that kind of stuff. I enjoy wearing, old clothes. I don't buy anything new. Except socks.
So do you have original Filson gear? Like,
yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Wow. I all my, when I'm not wearing work shirt like this, what I'm wearing right now is a rented shirt from Aramark. We have a uniform service. So, 'cause all my guys have shirts and stuff. And, so when I'm not wearing that, I'm wearing, you know, vintage Levi's and a Pendleton shirt, or when I'm outside, I've got my Filson, you know, my tin coat or my,
Where are you finding this stuff? I mean, they didn't make a lot of it. I mean, you can get brand new Filson now, but where are you finding a lot of this stuff?
Well, I buy all my clothes at the antique store. Okay. You know, out here on the West Coast, I'm not sure how it is. What town are you in?
So I live in coastal New Jersey. I'm about an hour south of New York City and an hour northeast of Philadelphia.
Okay. Yeah. So I've been east several times and I've noticed there's a difference in the antique stores where in your end of the country, it's old stuff. It's real old. Yeah. Or it's like 50s gas station signage and stuff like that. Out here, because we're 100 years behind you, our antique stores are 1900s to 1960s stuff. So there's full racks of vintage clothing. And it's not like old band t-shirts, but like, you know, Pendleton's and Filson and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's where I buy a lot of my clothes that I don't rent. And I don't wear a lot of it. You know, I'm always working. That's the thing is I'm in the shop 7 days a week. And so I'm always wearing my uniform. I don't wear my own stuff to the shop very often, just because I know I'm going to ruin it. So
when
I get the chance to wear,
you're like, oh, I'm just going to go there and do this one little thing, right? Well, that one little thing turns into one big thing, and you come home and you're like, oh man, I just ruined my favorite pair of jeans and that button down that I just bought a week ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And I'm like Pigpen. Like, I'm just constantly dirty anyways. So I really can't have nice stuff. So buying used vintage clothes, you know, they're usually already have a stain somewhere or a little nick or tear. So it's like, you know, it's not the end of the world if I do wear one out, but no, I enjoy the old stuff, old tools, old equipment. You know, watch a ton of black and white TV shows, stuff like that.
That's cool, man. That is super cool. So what is that dream car that you want to add, you know, outside of your custom work for your own personal use, you know, to add to your own personal collection? What is that dream car that you want that you're like, all right, I'm going to do this project and this is going to be my passion?
I have never got to keep a Scout that I've built.
Really?
I always end up selling them. Because either it's to further the business or to buy something else. Because what happens is I get these calls from people and they go, hey, my dad passed away. We got some trucks on the farm. Do you want to just buy them all? Well, I go out there and there's 25 trucks, Travelalls, and Scouts. And they're like, oh, we want $1,000 a piece. They're like, oh, shoot. Well, you know, which is well under market. Like right now, to buy a Scout of any condition for $1,000, you're doing great.
Yeah.
So to find a pile of, like, I just bought 13 out of a place over close to the outside of Portland. And, you know, so to come up with 25, 30 grand on the spot is tough. I mean, yeah, we're very busy, but I put every penny back into the business as far as my guys' wages, tooling, more parts of the website, that kind of thing. So I don't keep a lot of cash just laying around. So when something pops up that is a big dollar number, a lot of times I just sell the Scout that I'm driving or the Scout that I'm building or whatever it is that I'm working on. So I've never got to keep one. So I would like to build a nice Scout. Probably like a 73, 74 Scout 2 and just keep it.
That's cool. Any, you know, like special editions or, cause I know the Scout 2s had, like, especially in the 70s, some in the mid 70s, some crazy special editions that had, you know, insane decals and, like, you know, it was like very like retro type of stuff. Any, is there a specific like special edition or unique Scout?
Yeah. I mean, if I had to, I'd probably build like a Baja edition SS2, which is this, you know, soft door, soft top. Yeah, they were usually orange with a funny applique on the side and, you know, they weren't anything special drivetrain wise. You know, they just had 345s and four speeds or automatics, whatever. And they had a little bit of updated suspension. They had a roll bar. They had bucket seats that didn't tilt forward, just little details like that. But I've never actually owned an SS2 in any of the Scouts I bought. I've never owned an SS2. And then again,
have you come across
never having one?
Have you come across one?
Yeah. I've had several that I found and just turned over, because they weren't right. Cause like I said, if I'm going to build one, it's gotta be like this Baja cruiser, which is, you know, they were orange or white, or there's a couple other colors they were, because there were other versions of the SS2s that were like four cylinders and three speeds. They called them the Rancher Special. So they didn't have any seats. They had one seat and then everything else was open because it was for, you know, running fence line and in Wyoming, you know, doing rancher jobs. And so they made them really bare bones. And I've come across a couple of those and I've either passed them on to other people or just not bought them. Normally the prices on them are real high too, because everyone knows, they're like, hey, this is kind of special with these soft doors and soft top. So I'm going to add $3,000 to the asking price. And so I just pass on them.
And there's always somebody, you know, willing to pay it though.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, they always get bought. They always get bought. So, I'd probably build a Baja Cruiser.
That's cool. That's one thing I've learned in the classic four-wheel drive space. There is an excuse, the term, there is a butt for every seat. It doesn't matter how wild the build is, how crusty it is. There is definitely a butt for every seat. There is a buyer for everything out there, no matter how like off the wall it is. So that's cool.
Well, yeah.
Dan, I really, as we wrap up here, I really wanted to thank you for your time. Having somebody with your depth of knowledge in the harvester space is very rare, being able to talk to somebody. And I know our listeners definitely enjoyed it. So I want to thank you so much for your time today. And your participation in the Classic 4x4 podcast. Again, for all of you out there that that don't follow Dan, make sure you follow him on Instagram at Binder Boneyard. Check out his website if you need any parts for international harvesters, whether they're, you know, new, used, accessories, or you need that random body panel or a full body. Check out Binder Boneyard, and also listen to his podcast. He does a half hour quick podcast every week, and it's technical. So if you're into harvesters, that's where you're going to get your best knowledge. So Dan, thank you again so much for joining us today.
No, I appreciate you having me on. Grateful for the opportunity. I learned a lot talking to you beforehand, and I really appreciate all that. So thank you.
Hey, I'm looking forward to crossing paths at some point in the future. Thanks a lot, man.